Coming up on this week's book show, Ken Follett has sold more than 170 million books, including the acclaimed novel, The Pillars of the Earth. Now, Follett is out with a prequel titled The Evening and the Morning, an historical epic about the world emerging from the Dark Ages. Ken Follett on this week's book show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Ken Follett has sold more than 170 million books, including the acclaimed novel The Pillars of the Earth. Now, Follett is out with a prequel titled The Evening and the Morning, a historical epic about the world emerging from the Dark Ages, a time of terror, back to something that resembles quality and class, the Middle Ages. It is an epic journey into a historical past rich with ambition and rivalry, death and birth, love and hate, that ends where The Pillars of the Earth begins. Follett's first bestseller was Eye of the Needle, a spy story set in the Second World War. In 1989, The Pillars of the Earth was published and has since become his most popular novel. Again, the new novel is The Evening and the Morning, and it is a great pleasure to welcome Ken Follett to this week's book show. How are you?
I'm very well, Joe. How are you? And it's great to be back on the show.
It's wonderful to have you back on the program. You know, you're writing about the 900s, and wow, you wouldn't expect to read a book about so long ago and find so many parallels to what's happening right now.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? And, you know, I don't really seek for that parallels with the present day. You know, I'm just looking for a good story, but it does happen. It usually happens that some of the issues that the characters confront in the story and some of the problems that they're dealing with resonate with modern issues.
In writing this, obviously, you are looking at this time before what you were writing about in The Pillars of the Earth. Did you always have that in the back of your mind that you wanted this to be a prequel?
No. When I wrote The Pillars of the Earth, it never occurred to me that there would be a whole series of books about the town of Kingsbridge. Tell you the truth, Joe, if I'd known there was going to be a series of books, I might have given it a more original name than Kingsbridge. It's a pretty pedestrian name, King. I would have thought of something a bit unusual, I think. There are three or four places in the UK called Kingsbridge, and there are several in North America. There's a place called Kingsbridge in Texas, apparently. And I might have thought of something a bit more distinctive. However, I didn't foresee this, but it was such a big success that people started to say to me, when are you going to write another book like The Pillars of the Earth? And I'm a writer who wants to please the readers. Some of my friends say, I write to please myself. And if they like it, that's great. But that's not what I'm all about. And I say, boy, it's what I'm all about. You know, I think constantly about, will people like this? Will people believe that this could happen? Will they want to turn the page? So I think about that all the time. And when readers say to me, we'd like you to write another book like The Pillars of the Earth, well, I'm very warm to the idea.
So when it comes to this book, we should mention that, yes, so this is a Kingsbridge novel that brings us up to the point where The Pillars of the Earth begins. So we look at the characters in the evening and the morning and assume that they are early ancestors of the characters in those other Kingsbridge novels.
Yes, no characters continue from one book in this series to the next because there is always a gap between the stories. But for those readers who are, you know, making notes, they may notice that there are certain physical characteristics that recur. And they will say, oh, I know, he's got red hair and green eyes. He's inherited. I know where he inherited those genes. So, and there is, of course, there are a lot of characters in these books who have the talent for building and working with their hands. Obviously, the cathedral builders in the evening and the morning, one of the principal characters is a shipbuilder who also then learns to build churches in stone. And this talent is something that runs through the DNA of people in Kingsbridge. But there aren't actually characters who reappear in more than one book. I did something different with the trilogy, the Century Trilogy, which I wrote about the 20th century. In that story, in those three books, volume one is about one generation, volume two is about their children, volume three is about their grandchildren. And the parents and grandparents stay in the story a lot of the time. So, and that's a very enjoyable way to do it as well. But in the Kingsbridge series, that doesn't happen. And really, the continuing character, Joe, is the city, Kingsbridge itself. You know, they build a cathedral there in the Pillars of the Earth. In World Without End, those people live through the Black Death, a terrible plague, a bit like the plague that we're going through at the moment, but worse than COVID-19. And then in A Column of Fire, they live through the terrible religious wars of the 16th century and people struggle for religious freedom in that story. And that mainly takes place, or partly takes place, in Kingsbridge as well. So I thought, now, wouldn't it be interesting for me, and maybe for the readers too, to go back to the time when this was not a big important city, not a big wealthy place, when in fact maybe it was a little village. Maybe it was even less than a village. Maybe it was just a scatter of houses in a hamlet, five or six houses and a little church. And then the interesting story would be how it grows from those beginnings into an important place. And the reason I say that would be a good story is because this kind of thing always involves conflict. You're going to have people who say, yes, we should have a marketplace, we should have a bridge, we should have a cathedral, and then we can all prosper and the town can become a better place to live. And then you have people who say, no, we want things to stay the way they are. We don't want to change. We don't want people coming from miles around just to go to our church, our cathedral. We'd rather live a quiet life. And so you get a conflict between those two groups of people. And there are lots of stories in that. And, of course, that happens to be a type of conflict that is very familiar to modern-day people, the conflict between those who want progress and those who want things to remain the same.
Ken Follett is our guest on this week's book show. The new novel is The Evening and the Morning. And that's what's so fascinating about what you write is that, and we even touched on this at the very very beginning of our discussion about how relevant a book about the 900s can be. But obviously, these people, even though they lived hundreds of years ago, they still fell in love. They went to war. They wanted to be discovered. They wanted money. They wanted power. They got upset. They wanted revenge. So we can all obviously, as readers, relate to that. So you bring us to the early days of Kingsbridge. And as you say, it's a small, out-of-the-way place, and it begins to grow. How do you research something like that? How do you figure out how, at that time, places did indeed grow?
I began by making a tour of all the Anglo-Saxon buildings in England. There aren't very many. It wasn't a very long tour. The Anglo-Saxons didn't build much in stone. Most of their houses were, almost all their houses were wood and straw. But there are a few Anglo-Saxon buildings, and I do like to visit places and look at things myself. Of course, a lot of what I needed to know was in history books, and a lot of historians have diligently sifted through what little evidence we have about the Anglo-Saxon period and worked out how they did things, how the economy worked, how they bought and sold and traded and farmed and made stuff. So all of those books, I rely heavily on the work of historians, living and dead historians, who have helped us understand the past. The Anglo-Saxons didn't leave many traces. They didn't write much down. They weren't big for books and reading and writing, the Anglo-Saxons. Literacy declined after the Romans left, after the Roman Empire collapsed, literacy declined. But there were a couple of things that gave me enormous help in doing this research. One was the Bayeux Tapestry. This is a work of embroidery 60 yards long, and it's a strip cartoon. It consists of 70-something frames, each of which has a picture in it. It tells the story of the Norman conquest of England, but kind of accidentally, it also tells us a lot about everyday life in the 11th century. For example, we see people sitting down having dinner. We can see that their crockery and their cutlery and their drinking vessels, and we can see how they cooked. We see people chopping down trees, so we get to see the tools that they used. We see them on horseback, so we can see what their saddles were like. We can see the fact that they had stirrups, which were a fairly recent invention at the time. We see them with their dogs and with their pet birds, and all of that is tremendously helpful. This piece of embroidery, it's called a tapestry, but it's a piece of embroidery, was done in the 11th century, miraculously has survived all this time, 1,000 years, and it's on display in a museum in France in the city of Bayeux. There is also a copy in an English museum. And of course, the pictures are reproduced in many books. One of those books has been on my desk for the past 3 years. The other great source of information for me that was also such fun to visit was the Viking Ship Museum in Oslo in Norway. They actually have two full-size Viking ships that have been dug up out of muddy graves and found to be well preserved, put back together again, a little bit of renovation work, and these two great ships stand in this marvelous museum on the outskirts of Oslo. And they're very graceful. They look menacing. There's a dragon's head right at the front of the ship. And, that was just in case you made the mistake of thinking they might be friendly. The dragon's head is letting you know these people are not here to say hi, howdy, have a nice day. You can just imagine, as I do in the first chapter of The Evening and the Morning, standing on the shore and looking out over the sea and seeing a bunch of these menacing looking ships coming at you across the waves very fast. They were very fast ships. And if you saw that, you knew that in a couple of minutes, hell was coming to your town. So despite the relative lack of information about the Anglo-Saxon period, I did manage to find some sources that were helpful and inspiring too.
And it seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but it seems to me that your portrayal of the Vikings is different of what we often read about the Vikings.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, people think they're sexy. People think the Vikings are sexy. I don't think they're sexy at all. They were murderers and thieves and slavers. The Vikings ran the slave trade in the 11th century, 10th and 11th centuries. When they raided a town or village, they would come to the beach or they would come up river and they set fire to the place. They'd murder most of the people. They would steal everything that was made of silver or gold, church ornaments and that kind of thing. And they would take prisoner young men and women to sell as slaves. The Vikings had three great slave markets, one in Dublin in Ireland, one in Bristol, which is in the west of England, and one in Rouen, which is in northern France. And these wretched young people would be sold as slaves in these slave markets. So the Vikings, I don't see what's sexy about them. I think they're like the mafia. They make a living by making life miserable for everybody else.
I want to go back to the tapestry that you mentioned, of course. And what's interesting about that, too, is that there are panels of that missing. And was that of interest to you?
Well, to tell you the truth, not much. I mean, you know, I'm not sure what was in them. And of course, you can guess which bits of the story might have been left out. But really, what I liked was the depiction of unimportant things.
Mm.
You know, the actual battles. I don't deal with the Battle of Hastings, which is the great battle of the 11th century, only because it's been overdone. Too many people have written about that, and I don't want to repeat things that other people have done. So I don't deal with that battle. And what I'm interested in is the items of everyday life that everybody had to handle, the clothes and the hairstyles. You know, you could tell the Normans from the Anglo-Saxons by their hairstyles. The Normans had this really quite cool hairstyle. Their hair was long on the top, but at the back it was shaved all the way up to the crown of the head. So in the Bayeux Tapestry, any Norman in the story looks as if he's got a cat sitting on his head. It's very unattractive. But clearly it was the height of fashion in Normandy. And the English all have little moustaches, which is... So that's how you can tell them. You tell them by their hairstyles. And that kind of little thing, you know, that's so great.
And those little things, as you mentioned, so you are less interested in, say, William's coronation and much more interested in the dogs.
Yes, exactly right. Exactly right. Somebody pointed out to me that I quite often have a dog or two in the story. And I suppose that's because it's part of a person's character. I tweet, most days I tweet, and every now and again I tweet a picture of whatever my dogs are up to. And those are always here am I tweeting mostly about literature and books, but the tweets that get the most likes are always the one where there's a picture with the dogs in. I like dogs. People like dogs. I think there's a place for dogs in the story.
Well, I also love it. You're a Labrador guy, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I have. Those are just great dogs, just good chuckle-headed dogs.
Absolutely. And the great thing is they're completely safe with children.
Yes.
And, you know, when my grandchildren were little, they loved the dogs and they would do, you know, they would poke them in the eye and all that kind of thing. And the dogs would just like it. It was all attention. For Labradors, if they're getting attention, they're happy. And even if it's slightly uncomfortable attention, they're enormously tolerant. And so you can feel really comfortable with if little children and toddlers are playing with the dogs.
Real quick on the Bayeux Tapestry, which when I was reading about it, Charles Dickens, not impressed, said it is certainly the work of amateurs, very feeble amateurs at the beginning and very heedless, some of them too. Do you understand that thought?
No, I didn't know Dickens had written about it, actually. You've certainly told me something I didn't know. I wonder what got him wound up about it. you know, the depiction of people and horses and so on is not particularly skillful, but it's in accordance with medieval art. You know, the very the very graceful depiction of human beings that we see in Greek art and Roman art had been lost. Those by the Dark Ages, all those techniques had been lost. All that culture just melted away after the end of the Roman Empire. So Dark Ages art is not particularly sophisticated, and it's a little surprising if Charles Dickens expected it to be more sophisticated than it is. And also, you know, it's embroidery. It's not painting.
Right.
So it would be, even if you were quite a skilled painter, you might not be able to have quite the same realism in your human figures when you're using a needle and bits of coloured wool. So I'm a little puzzled. Mind you, Dickens could be a bit acerbic, couldn't he, when he got annoyed with something. He got very annoyed when he went to America. He didn't like it very much, and he was very nasty about America in some of his writings. You know, he's a guy who can, you know, he can get a little obsession going about something.
Absolutely.
Or could. Greatest novelist in our language, of course. We must, if we're making fun of him, we must remember that he was.
Yes, there's that aspect.
We all stand on his shoulders.
Let me talk to you a little bit about your early career. I find this fascinating. I don't know how you feel about it, in the sense that you started as a journalist, and given the historical value and beauty in these novels. I mean, do those roots, those journalistic roots, do you think, are they at the core of what you have done throughout your career?
Not really at the core. Being a journalist for 5 years was a help in some respects and not in others. For example, for 5 years, I was writing every day. And, you know, that, no matter what you're writing, just doing it all the time makes you a more fluent writer. So that was a good thing. And I also, you know, my curiosity developed. I enjoyed talking to people. And as a reporter, if you're on a non-controversial story, what we used to call a soft story, people are very happy to talk to you, and they explain their whole lives to you. It's very interesting. That aspect of things was fine. I did, however, get into the habit of writing in a very brisk style, no nonsense. You know, a newspaper story, and I worked for evening papers where 10 paragraphs was long. It was quite difficult for me when I started to write novels to change my style of writing. The novel reader does not want to be given all of the facts in 10 paragraphs. The novel reader wants to be drawn into an imaginary world. And that process is slower, and it requires a completely different style of writing. And I had to unlearn my journalistic style in order to write novels. So in some ways, it was a benefit to me being a reporter, and in some ways it gave me some issues that I had to deal with. I certainly don't regret it. I mean, it's a fun job for a young man to have. Every day is different. You get into the office at 8:30 in the morning, and you have no idea what story you're going to be working on. The news editor will say to you, there's been a big fire on the other side of town. Go and find out what's happening. Or they'll say, there's a murder trial on at the court today. I want you to cover it. He'll send you off. It's that's the kind of reporter I was. I didn't have a specialty most of the time, so I would just be sent to do whatever was the latest story. We sometimes call that kind of reporter a fireman, because he's sent off to wherever the action is. The French people, in French, the word for that is chiens écrasé, which means dogs that have been run over, which is what French people call a reporter who does a different thing every day. Well, chiens écrasé.
It says a lot about the culture too, doesn't it? I mentioned in the introduction, Eye of the Needle. I read that book within the last year. man, that still holds up as just a beautiful, amazing novel. What was it that brought you from that genre of the thriller, of an edge of your seat thriller, to writing books like this, like The Evening and the Morning, that are sprawling, that are much bigger and much grander in scale?
It was the cathedrals. I was interested in cathedrals. I used to go and visit cathedrals. I spent a long time. I got interested in the story of how they were built. You know, sooner or later, when you visit those wonderful buildings, before too long, everybody finds themselves asking the question, why is this here? Why did they, you know, why did medieval people want one of these? It's huge, it's very beautiful, but it was very expensive to build. It was difficult to build. And of course, the people who built it lived in wooden huts and slept on the floor. And yet they built these lavish, gorgeous buildings. And as I became interested in why the cathedrals were built, who the people were who built the cathedrals and how they did it, I began to think that there might be a really good novel in the building of a cathedral. But the kind of novel which, as opposed to a thriller, which you read quite quickly in a few days, the kind of novel that you'd live with for a month or two. It was my conviction that this could be a really special book.
You know, I have to say that I know you did this for charity, and it was absolutely beautiful. But you wrote a book just last year, a short history of the meaning of cathedrals, about Notre Dame and, of course, the fire that engulfed it and just devastated the structure. It is just a real treasure of a book, because not only is it talking about, as the title would indicate, that the meaning of cathedrals overall, but of Notre Dame, and drawing on your interest was really fascinating.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed that book. I was very pleased to write it and make a small contribution to the charity. People have enjoyed it, so I'm very pleased.
And it's of something that you think that can't be touched, that you realize is so fragile.
Exactly. Yes, it was very shocking to all of us to see that marvelous building, such a familiar building, almost an institution, to see that in flames was terribly shocking.
Well, it has been an absolute joy speaking to you. The new novel is The Evening and the Morning, the prequel to The Pillars of the Earth. It is published by Viking. It is one of the most anticipated novels of the fall, and with good reason. It is just beautiful and stunning in every sense. Ken Follett, I thank you very much for spending time with us. What a great pleasure to be in your company.
Joe, it was a pleasure for me, and thank you for having me on the show, and I hope we can talk again one day.
Again, Ken Follett's new novel is The Evening and the Morning. It is published by Viking. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.